Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism. I'm Pat Donahue. I'm here with Dan Goldsberry and C Money Burns. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm good. What's happening, everybody?
Not much, other than the steady drumbeat of news that's making it very hard for me to have any type of optimistic outlook. But on today's episode, we're talking to Ben Norton. We're going a little bit outside of our normal zone of domestic issues and talking to Benjamin Norton, who is a journalist and author. He started a publication called Multipolarista, which is basically reimagining the world as opposed to having a unipolar or bipolar, you know, of world powers, having multiple powers that are kind of grappling for world dominance or for a say in the world. And he reports out of Latin America. A lot of his coverage focuses on Latin America and kind of takes a view that is not U.S.-centric, is not kind of in line with the U.S. State Department. And it takes an open-minded approach to countries like Cuba and Venezuela. And so we'll talk about those countries and some other developments in Latin America, namely Puerto Rico and kind of the difficulties that they've struggled through as a U.S. territory with, you know, some of the baggage that comes with being associated with the U.S., but without the ability to vote and kind of have their own say in federal elections as well. So a lot of fun stuff and interesting stuff that we'll be talking about with Ben Norton later on this episode.
I've never actually heard, I've heard of a multipolar world, but I like the idea of not, most news articles that I click on, you know, unless I'm really digging, they're always from like the viewpoint of United States power and, you know, basically imperialism and the idea that the people of Latin America might have a perspective that's different, or that, you know, oil embargoes might really fuck over a whole country. I think he said that according to the UN, 99% of Venezuelan oil revenue has been, I don't know if it's squandered or if it's just, you know, siphoned off or whatever, but basically they've lost the ability to have any of their own natural resources used for the betterment of their people. Like that perspective I've never heard from any US media.
Well, and not just the idea of an oil embargo, but in the case of Cuba, it's a full-on blockade, right? So like we look at COVID and their response to COVID, they knew from the outset that collaboration with other countries on development of a vaccine was going to be very difficult. So they set to work right away developing their own vaccines, and they actually developed a number of them that are successful. They rely on more traditional vaccine technology, but they have now vaccinated their population, vaccinated their kids, and they are offering it kind of as a vaccine tourism situation. So if someone travels from another country and is not vaccinated, they can receive the vaccine for free from the Cuban national health system. And I thought that was a marvel, you know, and he kind of points out that Cuba's survival up to this point in the midst, you know, in spite of the blockade from the U.S., it's really a miracle, right? The fact that the Castro regime, you know, in its current ideation has survived is a miracle. And also, you know, I asked him, you know, what is the perspective we're missing when we in the U.S. consume media that is about Cuba? Like we'll see recently, you know, there was the talk of the SOS Cuba protests, which were made to look legitimate from the U.S. media standpoint, but were really fomented by U.S. State Department and CIA-backed forces, and again involved the, you know, an upper class in Cuba that wants more ability to hoard their own wealth and not share it with the state. And that's really what the protests are about. So, you know, interesting to hear his perspective and also to understand that he's not just sharing a different perspective. He is on the ground in Havana. He's on the ground in Caracas, in Venezuela, and collecting testimony and interviewing people and interviewing working class people and poor people that, you know, don't often get a say when the media shows up to do a story in a city.
Yeah, I think that's important about what Ben does is, you know, most of the U.S. mainstream media is owned by very rich people who have very vested interests in propagating a very specific message and, you know, work hand in hand with the U.S. government to get information from them, to get privileged quotes, to get unsourced information. They often offer editorial control to departments like CIA, FBI, State Department. If you don't trust the messages coming out of the mainstream media, it's important to seek out other sources. And it's important to seek out the other side of what U.S. media is telling you to see the whole story. Then presents an interesting mirror image of some stuff we've seen in U.S. news, like with all the sanctions being put on Russia, a big deal was being made about them being blocked out of the SWIFT financial system. And that seemed like, oh, a really great novel way to do modern warfare without bombs, you know, financial warfare, block them from the financial system. But that same system is being used by the U.S. to further blockade countries like Venezuela and Cuba, who are totally blocked out of processing any credit in the U.S. system in U.S. dollars or with like MasterCard or Visa, which blocks them out of like a majority of the kinds of transactions that normally keep an economy afloat. It's important when we're being told by U.S. media and legacy media that this is an important tool that's not going to kill anybody but is going to get us leverage, that it is being used to starve people. It is being used to blockade countries by the same country that's touting it as kind of a casualty-free economic warfare.
It is interesting that, speaking of Venezuela, that the oil embargo, it sounds like there's talks about it being lifted, but it's only on the timeline and within the vested interests of the U.S. government. If there was no war in Ukraine, I mean, that shit would probably sit indefinitely, right? Isn't that what history tells us? That, you know, we would just lock them out. And I, as an anecdote, I have a friend I've been texting with her for most of the evening, and she's from Venezuela, and she was sharing how when she buys food for her relatives there, and she said, no one's eating meat, no one's eating fruit. You know, it's basically down to like, you know, rice and beans, that sort of shit. And when she buys stuff, she buys it from a US-based app. And then in the country, they distribute the food. But like, no one ever sends money there anymore. And if she wanted to fly there, she actually can't. I didn't know this. You know that people can't fly to Venezuela.
Well, that's part of these SWIFT transaction blockings, is that they can't directly accept remittances from the U.S. And even any third-party businesses not based in the U.S., if they do business with these countries, there are sanctions put on them individually. That's Ben gets into a little bit of that as well. This goes really deep. And I think it's worth questioning why the U.S. government wants to punish this system so much. Like, what is the fear of what
they're
going to do? Yeah, like that's why seeking out, you know, we've used the word before, heterodox news sources that are in opposition to mainstream media, or maybe present a view that at first glance seems kind of like dissident. Consider where the information is coming from, to use your media literacy, you know, you verify your sources, things like you pseudonymous reportage or unsigned bylines or no secondary sources. You definitely want to be wary of that sort of stuff. But an outfit like Ben's Multipolarista is very well vetted journalistically. There's a lot of links to outside material to factually verify the stuff that he's talking about. And it shows that it's a good source to get alternate takes on what's happening in the world outside the U.S., outside of a U.S.-centric filter.
One of the things that I talked to Ben about is, you know, recently we've seen Puerto Rico having blackouts across the island. And just after Hurricane Maria, the Trump administration basically auctioned off the rights to administer Puerto Rico's power grid. So they basically privatized the power grid. And the company that won the bid has just done a really, really poor job of administering power. And so it's been a mess for Puerto Ricans. And again, with that situation, we don't hear the perspective of average Puerto Ricans. We hear of like what it looks like on the ground, maybe, but you don't get that anger from the Puerto Rican citizenry of the fact that, you know, they're again being treated in such a paternalistic way with decisions, you know, big decisions being made for them, just like the austerity that they've been under for a really long time because of a debt, you know, agreement. Again, we don't hear what that feels like on the ground from the average Puerto Rican. And, you know, we also talked a little bit about AMLO, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, who is a socialist president of Mexico. And since my conversation with Ben, AMLO has basically set it up so that the lithium mines in Mexico have been nationalized. So lithium is a huge resource going forward as we look to the development of further, you know, cell phone technology, and computers all have lithium in them. And so this is huge for the Mexican people, but the news really was not loudly trumpeted in the U.S., right? If we do hear a story about AMLO, it's just about how he met with the U.S. official, or we occasionally get stories of how he's, you know, unpopular, but unpopular among the rich in Mexico. But we don't get these stories. And so Simone was saying, I think it's really important that if we're going to try to look at what's going on in Latin America, that we look to multiple sources and we look to sources that are outside of the U.S. mainstream narrative.
I think as leftists, you know, if you look at some of the biggest achievements on the left in the past 20 to 30 years, they've been in Latin America, they've been in the global South. You know, the U.S. labor movement has only recently started waking up, but labor has been a very strong force in politics in Latin America for 30 years. And even in just the last recent few years, a few governments have turned over to far leftist activists. And there's a lot of popular opinion that if, quote unquote, revolution is going to come, it's not going to be from white Western European countries dominated by global finance capital. It's going to come from the global South. So I think paying attention to news in those places, labor developments, political developments in those places that are outside the Western media narrative is essential if you want to be a principled and informed leftist and really just, you know, a human who's apprised of what's going on in the world around them.
And also understanding how much U.S. capital and, by extension, U.S. corporate media has a vested interest in quieting those types of stories and kind of furthering the idea that it's all unrest and it's all messy and dangerous in Latin America. You're going to get those stories far more often because, you know, they're not going to want you to see leftists succeeding or efforts to nationalize entire, you know, sectors of the economy succeeding in helping the poor of that country achieve a better standard of living, right? So that's the kind of mess, that's the trap that we fall into if we trust only U.S. media on issues like this.
U.S. media is owned by capitalists, and capitalists advertise on it. They have a vested interest in making capitalism look good and making things that are opposed to capitalism look bad. So why would you have a conversation about capitalism totally within those auspices? You need to seek out outside news sources if you want to be able to discuss it intelligently and to understand it from a global perspective and from a systemic perspective.
Hey, Pat, back to Puerto Rico for a second. Before we started recording, you were mentioning, and it flew totally under my radar, that Congress apparently is giving the Puerto Rican people some options with regard to their own sovereignty, or non-binding, right? Like a, I don't know what you call it, a referendum or a...
They're calling it a plebiscite. But yeah, and to back it up even more, Dan, you had a great question earlier, and it's not a reflection on you. It's a reflection on the fact that world history is not well taught throughout the U.S. to anyone.
Educated by all white people too, by the way. So
right. So
the question
you had earlier on was how did we end up with Puerto Rico as not a state, but as a U.S. territory? And the answer to that, you know, goes back to U.S. imperialism and imperialistic wars, where in the Spanish-American War in 1898, the U.S. invaded Puerto Rico during the war. And after the war, in signing a treaty, and in those days, often signing a treaty also meant exchanging territories, or often the victor of the war would be gifted a number of territories by the losing power. Well, Puerto Rico was given to the U.S. as a territory, so not a state, but a territory, which would give us a huge leg up in trade relations. And Puerto Rico, at the time, was a world leader in production of sugarcane, which you can, you know, obviously tell would be a huge part of, you know, a huge economic boon to the U.S. to have full control there and kind of like a one-way trading partner on sugar. But as a territory, they did not have the ability to have autonomy over their own decisions. And they had to pay U.S. taxes, but they did not get the ability to vote in U.S. federal elections. And so they've often, Puerto Ricans have often complained about this. There was actually in the late 60s, there was a group of armed Puerto Ricans who stormed the U.S. Capitol and fired off a weapon in U.S. House chambers to kind of call attention to the issue and to call for independence for Puerto Rico. But most recently, AOC and a number of other U.S. Congress representatives have passed a resolution which allows for a plebiscite, meaning a vote to take place in Puerto Rico. And the structure of it was agreed upon. So what the vote will be on is three options. The first option is independence for Puerto Rico. The second option would be statehood. And the third option is independence, but with a military agreement that kind of calls for the U.S. to be a protection force for Puerto Rico, which feels a lot like what they're doing right now. So I'm not sure how attractive that option will be, but it'll be interesting to see how this is carried out and what the decision is among Puerto Rican voters.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But then do you know, with a plebiscite, like what, to what extent does Congress need to ratify it? I mean, I'm assuming some dusty old conservatives are not going to be in favor of the Puerto Rican people having a vote in United States elections.
Well, I think the most interesting one, and the one that would require further, you know, horse trading, further agreements made in Congress, and I think ratification from a certain percentage of U.S. states, would be that decision to become a U.S. state, right? So that's the one that would really, I think, set off a whole lot more negotiation and action in Congress before anything actually happened. But yeah, so this is, I think, a great chance for our listeners to step outside our normal comfort zone and listen to a heterodox view, someone who is on the ground in Latin America in socialist countries talking to average everyday people and collecting their viewpoints. And I think everyone will find this interview interesting and also kind of eye-opening if you're used to the U.S. Corporate media perspective of Latin America. So let's stick around and check out this interview with Ben Norton of Multipolarista.
Our guest on this episode is Benjamin Norton, journalist, writer, and filmmaker. He's based in Latin America and is the founder and editor of Multipolarista, an online publication and podcast. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Ben. It's great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me. And I like the name of the show, Trickle Down Socialism.
Thanks. We thought that was a good play on kind of the failure of Reaganomics. And just the hope that some of that socialism that's feeding all of the corporations could somehow trickle down to us.
Supply side socialism.
There you go. That's it. So first of all, speaking of names and premises of publications, Multipolarista, Multipolarist deserves some exploration. So could you explain why you chose this name for your online newspaper and what our world might look like as we transition from U.S. hegemony and dominance by one group? What is your vision of multipolar society?
Well, the reason I chose that name, there are two main reasons. One, it's because I was trying to think of an idea that kind of brings together all of my journalism, which is largely focused on, you know, U.S. imperialism, foreign policy, geopolitics, international relations, and the kind of historic shifts that we're seeing in the world right now. And I created this before Russia invaded Ukraine, but, you know, there were so many other things also happening. The integration of China and Russia and also Iran into this kind of Eurasian institutional apparatus with, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative that China's doing around the world, but also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And there are also many other things happening, you know, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Argentina joined the Belt and Road Initiative. And we saw Iran and Venezuela doing more and more economic deals and trade, not just of oil, but also of food and other products. So there's a lot of very interesting things happening geopolitically. And I thought the idea of, you know, multipolarity and this documenting this historic shift that we're going through is a good way to kind of tie together all of those topics. And then the other reason I chose the name is because I live in Latin America and I do a lot of reporting on Latin America, and I do a lot of reporting in Spanish as well, in both English and Spanish. So I wanted to do something that could work both in English and Spanish because, you know, I've worked at other media outlets before. And I would often tell people in Latin America what the outlet was, and they would be like, I don't know what that is, because it's some English name. They wouldn't know how to write it. So now it works well in English and Spanish, so it's easier to help bridge that gap. And that's something that I've been trying to do in recent years, is try to help bridge this gap between, you know, progressive independent English language media and progressive independent Spanish language media, because there are a lot of really good independent journalists and analysts and scholars writing in the Spanish language media. There's so many cool websites. You know, some of my friends in Venezuela have this great website called Misión Verdad, which is really good. In Mexico, over around the AMLO movement and fourth transformation, there's been a huge growth in these progressive independent outlets like Sin Censura and many others. So, you know, I've been trying to bridge those gaps, because unfortunately there's not a lot of interchange between the Latin American left and the English-speaking U.S. and Western European left. Usually, if you look at a lot of the alternative and independent media outlets in the U.S. that are focused on socialism and progressive issues and all of that, if they focus on international issues and collaborate with foreign journalists, it's usually in Europe, which replicates this kind of Eurocentrism. And I think we really need to break out of that. It is very toxic. It is very dangerous for the left in the United States. And we need to be collaborating more and more with people in the global South. So that kind of explains my perspective on the outlet Multipolarista. You know, I accept submissions from people and I collaborate with the journalists around the world. And, you know, what is multipolarity? I mean, really briefly, the name is pretty suggestive. It's pretty clear. It is a kind of political order that is dominated by multiple political powers, in which there are multiple poles, politically speaking, as opposed to a unipolar order that we've seen at the least since the early 1990s, since the overthrow of the Soviet Union and the rise of neoliberalism. And you could say even going back really into the 1980s, with the decline of the Soviet Union and the eventual overthrow of the Soviet Union, we saw this moment in which the world was really dominated entirely by the U.S. empire, by U.S. capital, by Wall Street, by the IMF, by the World Bank. The Washington Consensus, as it came to be known, was imposed on large parts of the planet. And the idea that you could have another path of economic development, another path of self-determination for a country, was just rendered irrelevant and impossible. And we saw these sophists, these fake philosophers like Francis Fukuyama, who famously declared the end of history and insisted that this model of bourgeois democracy with neoliberal capitalism is supposedly the end of history, and it's going to be the model that every country on earth implements. And of course, that was proven to be completely wrong. And in many ways, it was actually Latin America that proved, the Latin American left that proved that was wrong. And we had the rise of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 1998 when he was campaigning for president. He actually gave a historic speech in 1998 in which he said that the world is unipolar. During the Cold War, it was bipolar. And we now want a multipolar world. That Chavez said that in 1998. He was very prescient. Of course, multipolarity did not come for many years until many years later. But Chavez, when he came in, he won the election in 1999 and became president. He ushered in, he helped to create this new movement and develop the concept of socialism in the 21st century and worked with other countries in Latin America to build institutions of regional integration, like most famously the ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance, but also lesser known organizations like UNASUR and CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. These were all attempts to kind of put a check on US imperialism and US unipolar hegemony and provide new forms of regional integration because, of course, imperialists know that when you divide and conquer, it's much easier to control a country or region of the world. But if that region can unify internally, not only politically, but economically, then they can challenge Wall Street. They can challenge U.S. corporations. And the Bolivarian Alliance was not just a political alliance. It is an economic alliance. It was Chavez had the idea of trying to do barter between countries. So Venezuela has a lot of oil. And for instance, you'll say Nicaragua has a lot of coffee. So Venezuela would give its oil in return for coffee, and they wouldn't even need to have exchange of currency, which means you don't need to worry about, you know, converting bolivares into cordobas or using dollars or anything like that. So these were very revolutionary ideas. And then, of course, we saw the creation of the BRICS. And the BRICS system, which is BRICS, that stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Mm-hmm. It was an attempt to try to create this new apparatus economically, to create alternatives to the World Bank and the IMF, integrating these large global South economies, well, also Russia, but Russia as being kind of semi-peripheral economy. And Brazil, under Lula da Silva, the left-wing Workers' Party, played a leading role in trying to create this new apparatus to help build multipolarity. And since then, Lula da Silva has returned to speaking about multipolarity. He published this manifesto with the Progressive International talking about what a multipolar world could look like. We've also heard Evo Morales has been talking about multipolarity. Nicolás Maduro has continued talking a lot about multipolarity. So on the Latin American left, this is a concept that has become very prominent, very important. And the idea is simply a model to challenge the hegemony of U.S. imperialism. And of course, there are downsides to multipolarity. And as I often point out, I mean, I think Turkey is a good example of this. Turkey represents how, you know, this is a country that is part of NATO and collaborates with the U.S. war machine, for instance, in the war to try to destroy Syria. Turkey is militarily occupying a large chunk of northern Syria in collaboration with al-Qaeda and extremist groups. But Turkey also plays a complex role. I mean, Turkey, for instance, has been supportive of Venezuela. Turkey has also bought weapons from Russia. Turkey has not joined in this campaign to try to isolate Russia and China, this new Cold War. So I think that represents that, look, with multipolarity, you also have countries that in their own narrow capitalist interest, they're going to pursue what their own national interests are, as Turkey is doing. And that also involves collaborating with Azerbaijan to wage a war of aggression against Armenia. So multipolarity doesn't necessarily mean the end of imperialism, but it does provide more space for alternative models of economic development. And when you have these socialist movements in the global South that are trying to have breathing room because they're under crippling sanctions by the US and they're blocked out of the international financial system, multipolarity does offer them an opportunity to have other economic agreements and trade partners. And they can work with China and Russia and Iran and even India, you know, other countries around the world to try to develop their economies. And they're no longer, in this era that we're in now, they're no longer under the same siege-like conditions that Cuba was during the special period in the 1990s. And the fact that Cuba survived that is an incredible testament to what the Cuban Revolution has accomplished. But no one in Cuba, I mean, I know many Cubans, I speak to Cubans a lot. I'm you know, I've collaborated with Cuban journalists. Like, no one wants to go back to that period in the 1990s. It was extremely difficult. And the reason that they don't have to go back to that period is because this new multipolar moment has created more economic possibilities. And especially the rise of China, which we can talk about, has really changed the economic map.
Great. Yeah, that's a really detailed answer. And I think it paints a clear picture of what you mean with that word. In terms of the barter system that Venezuela developed under Chavez, my favorite example is the Doctors for Oil with Cuba. I thought that was some genius right there. So the New York Times recently put out a bit of an attack on you with claims that you were publishing quote unquote conspiracy theories, a picture of your face with a red line through it. What's going on with this attack?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of this historic shift that we're seeing in the world and the decline of U.S. unipolar hegemony, we've seen that the response of Washington has been to wage a new Cold War. And more, I think it's important to talk about that blatantly, honestly, that it is a new Cold War. We shouldn't mince our words. And we've seen that the media outlets that act as handmaidens for the U.S. government, and the New York Times being one of the key examples of that, have really joined in this information war. And when I say information war, that's not hyperbole. The CIA director, William Burns, who was also, by the way, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, he said in a speech and in testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee this March that the U.S. is waging an information war. He used that language, information war, and he boasted that the U.S. is winning the information war against Russia, as he said. So we should be very clear that, you know, these attacks in the New York Times, they're part of a larger campaign of information warfare. And the fact that many of them cite anonymous U.S. government officials, it just really gives away the game. Of course, the New York Times is very close to the U.S. government. The former reporter at the Times, James Risen, who later joined The Intercept, when he joined The Intercept, he published this very long expose talking about his experience at the Times and talking openly about how his editors would willingly, voluntarily collaborate with the U.S. government, and how anytime they were going to publish a story that could challenge so-called national security interests, that they would send the story to the U.S. government to make sure that there is nothing there that they didn't like. And if there was something that U.S. officials didn't like, they would excise it. They would remove it from the story in the New York Times. So it shows this very cozy relationship between the New York Times and the U.S. government. And the New York Times has been going after independent journalists who dare to challenge the NATO propaganda narrative on Ukraine and China and Russia and anything like that. And this isn't the only attack they've done. They've also done attacks on other friends and colleagues, including a close friend of mine, Lee Camp, who's a good left-wing comedian. And Lee Camp, you know, he's an activist who comes from the grassroots anti-war movement, the anti-racist movement, the environmental movement in the United States. He's an American. And he had a show, a comedy show called Redacted Tonight, that was hosted by him, produced by him, but was transmitted on RT, which, oh no, evil RT, the Ruskies. So the New York Times published this smear piece attacking him and all this nonsense. And, you know, it's not the only example, but the New York Times published this piece this April, and the basic premise of the article is that Chinese media outlets are echoing so-called Russian disinformation. And when they say Russian disinformation, they mean the Russian perspective on the war in Ukraine. And when they say disinformation, it's not actually disinformation. It's usually true facts, but they just call it disinformation. And they cite an interview that I did on RT with Lee Camp. Again, this is an American comedian, a left-wing activist, who had editorial control over his show. And it was actually an interview that I did with Lee Camp on February 23rd, which is a day before Russia invaded. And they try to portray it as part of this so-called Russian disinformation to justify the invasion, even though I don't know how Putin can do such five-dimensional chess that he could somehow make me do an interview before he even invaded.
Yeah, but set anyway, you up whatever. As like a little preview there. Yeah,
yeah. So
that would be amazing.
And then I also did an interview. I do interviews with tons of media outlets. I've done interviews with Qatari media, Al Jazeera. I've done interviews with Turkish media, TRT. I've done interviews with Japanese and Indian media. And I've done interviews with Chinese, Iranian, and Russian media. And they cited an interview that I did with a Chinese media outlet in which I discussed the war in Ukraine and the role of the U.S. government in backing a coup d'etat, a violent coup in 2014 in Ukraine that overthrew the democratically elected government. And the New York Times claimed that I was part of this vast conspiracy theory that was being spread by Russian and Chinese media. And they published a screenshot of a video that was posted by this Chinese media outlet, this video clip of me, and they crossed it out with a red line. And basically, what they're saying is that they're trying to accuse me of helping spread so-called Russian disinformation and Chinese disinformation, even though it is an objective fact that the U.S. backed a coup in Ukraine in 2014. Of course, they didn't even mention any of the evidence that I discussed in that interview. They left out all of the evidence because they're extremely dishonest propagandists at the New York Times. And that evidence includes a smoking gun in which in February 2014, the top U.S. State Department official, Victoria Nuland, who's a hardcore right-wing hawk, she was in Ukraine along with John McCain, meeting with the right-wing extremist forces in Ukraine who overthrew the government. And there's this leaked recording of a phone call in which Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, they're discussing who the leaders of the Ukrainian government will be after the coup. And they name this guy specifically named Yatsenyuk, and they refer to him affectionately as Yats. And Victoria Nuland says, Yats is the guy. It has to be Yats. Yats needs to be prime minister. He has the economic experience, which means he's a neoliberal Chicago boy. And that's exactly what happened. A few days after the coup in February 2014, he became prime minister, Yatsenyuk, this US-backed right-wing neoliberal. So the idea that it's a conspiracy theory is a conspiracy theory. It is an objective historical fact. And it really shows that the New York Times, the headline of this article was something about alternate reality in Chinese media. But it really shows that the New York Times is the one living in alternate reality, where the idea that the U.S. government would organize a coup d'etat, as it's done dozens of times across the world, in Chile and Iran and Guatemala and Venezuela and Bolivia and Honduras and Indonesia, and you can go down the list so many times. The idea that that's a conspiracy theory shows that the New York Times is the one actually living in an alternate reality.
Yeah, that idea of Nuland just kind of like picking a name and saying that's the person. It sounds like she's picking a fantasy football team or something. It's just wild to have that going on. So as I was prepping for this interview and getting ready to ask you questions about how the U.S. treats a territory like Puerto Rico, the Supreme Court just came down with a near unanimous ruling that denied a Puerto Rican resident SSI, basically disability benefits that are available to people in mainland U.S. And he had been living in New York City and had just kind of moved back to Puerto Rico and not declared that until 4 years later. They tried to claw back those benefits. So Justice Sonia Sotomayor was the lone dissent, as the rest of justices voted against residents of PR receiving benefits. How does this decision fit the general pattern of how the U.S. responds to need in Puerto Rico?
Well, I mean, Puerto Rico is a colony, and this really reflects the fact that although Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, they're still second-class citizens because they're colonized. And I mean, the fact that a Puerto Rican can't receive federal disability benefits shows that that's second-class citizenship. What do you call that? If a citizen can't receive benefits from a federal program, then they don't have the same rights as other U.S. citizens. I mean, it's really blatant. And people need to keep in mind, I mean, the fact that this had to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think really reflects the history of the Supreme Court's extremely racist rulings. And we should go back to understand that there still are explicitly racist cases that the Supreme Court ruled on called the insular cases. They're not that well known. They're not taught in most schools. But 100 years ago, the Supreme Court had a series of rulings called the insular cases. And in those court rulings, they say that Puerto Rico is inhabited by, quote, this is an exact quote, alien races. The U.S. Supreme Court referred to the Puerto Rican people as alien races, and it referred to them, this is an exact quote, as, quote, an uncivilized race. This is the language, this is the literal letter of the law of these Supreme Court rulings, 100-year-old rulings called the insular cases. So the fact that now the Supreme Court is saying that Puerto Ricans can't get, you know, federal disability benefits, I mean, unfortunately, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, it is not. And thank you for bringing up the insular cases. So we've seen massive protests in Puerto Rico about the austerity measures, which I'd like to get into in a minute. After Hurricane Maria, the power grid in Puerto Rico was auctioned off to a U.S.-Canadian power company. Recently, there was a massive island-wide blackout. How much of this power outage is the result of privatization of the power infrastructure?
Well, pretty much all of it. I mean, it's pretty clear. Before, Puerto Rico did not have consistent blackouts. Then they privatized the power grid, and now there are constant blackouts. What a very confusing situation. I wonder what could be happening here. No, I mean, the U.S. government has controlled Puerto Rico's finances for years now, since the Obama administration. Let's be clear, it was the Obama-Biden administration passed the PROMESA legislation, which is a horribly disgustingly cynically named piece of legislation. Of course, people don't know PROMESA is promise in Spanish, but you know, they tried to portray this as the promise to help Puerto Rico. This was a kind of neo-colonial, you know, debt trap, or a neo-colonial system imposed on Puerto Rico over its debt trap. Puerto Rico was trapped in this odious debt from these vulture capitalists. It could never pay it off. And you did a series of corrupt neoliberal governments that just made that debt even worse. And the U.S. federal government imposed a financial oversight board that is literally referred to as the junta. That's not just proverbially. If you go to the official website of the U.S. government, of the Federal Management Oversight Board, the website calls it the junta. And for people who don't know about, you know, the history of Latin America, I mean, junta can mean like council, but in the context of Latin American modern history, junta is also frequently used to refer to a junta militar, which means like a military coup, like the leadership of a military coup. So the U.S. imposed this colonial control board that manages Puerto Rico's finances, that, by the way, is also similar to what the U.S. imposed on Detroit, which is kind of internal colonialism. And the people of Puerto Rico don't have control over their own finances. And the people on this control board are a bunch of like right-wing conservative capitalists. They are like venture capitalists. And they are all fiscal hawks who talk about why the people of Puerto Rico have to have the minimum wage cut, even though the people of Puerto Rico have some of the lowest minimum wage in all of the territorial United States. And they also have been cutting benefits, cutting pensions, and cutting public employment. They've been imposing horrible structural adjustment and austerity on Puerto Rico. And one of those initiatives was privatizing the electrical grid and selling it to this North American company, Luma Energy, L-U-M-A. And there's also elements of extreme corruption there because the board members of Luma are making hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars a year. And they're managing this company that is in Puerto Rico, where over 50% of Puerto Ricans live in poverty. I mean, that fact is incredible, and it's almost never talked about. I mean, in the U.S. and the continental U.S., it's around 20% of the population. Although there's the official statistics are, I think, are 12%, but there's a lot of people who say that the actual number is probably 12%. Sorry, around 20%. But we're talking about in Puerto Rico, the rate of poverty is over 50%. The official number is 52.3% poverty, and that's almost never discussed. And by the way, in addition to having these massive blackouts ever since the privatization, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans have also had their energy bills skyrocket. We're talking about 2 or 3 times increased. So, you know, if you were paying, I don't know what, $50, $60 a month, now they're paying $150, $200 a month. And this is in a territory, Puerto Rico, a colony, where some people with good jobs only make $1,000 a month. And if you're a teacher, I mean, there were these massive protests recently over the poverty wages that teachers were being forced to live by, these poverty wages that were like $1,000 a month in a territory where the prices in Puerto Rico are basically the same prices as in the rest of the United States, or even more. So we're talking about horrible economic policies imposed on Puerto Rico that reflect its colonial status. These are the kinds of policies that colonial powers imposed on colonies to bleed the colonies dry.
Right. I appreciate you using the term colony instead of territory, which I think kind of obfuscates like the truth of the matter and the truth of the relationship there. So you kind of have really spelled out why the protests are going on and why it's such an unfair situation with the austerity measures put in place. But what do you think is next for Puerto Rico? You know, protests in 2019 were able to successfully push out a governor. Do you see a potential for protests to change the austerity under which they're living now? What do you think might come next?
The situation in Puerto Rico is very difficult. I collaborate a lot with Puerto Rican journalists, independent, you know, activists and academics. And I've done some interviews talking about these issues and the protests, and people can find those at Multipolarista. And, you know, they all say very similar things, that the situation is very hard to deal with. Organizing in Puerto Rico is difficult because so many people leave. Because you have U.S. citizenship, if you're in Puerto Rico, there are so many pressures to try to force Puerto Ricans to leave. And then now there's this kind of further colonization where, because if the U.S. government says that if you're a U.S. citizen and you live in Puerto Rico for 51% of the year, you don't have to pay federal income tax. So it's encouraging all of these tech capitalists, especially these crypto capitalists, to go to Puerto Rico and live there basically as this kind of, you know, fiscal paradise. And they buy these huge McMansions and live in these gated compounds, and they pay local Puerto Ricans poverty wages to manage their mansions, and they pay no federal income tax. And that is also fueling a process of gentrification. Excuse me, sorry, I'm getting over a cough here. And then what that also does is it pushes up property prices, which means that Puerto Ricans living with these poverty wages, again, 52% of which are in poverty, are now forced to pay even more for rent. And it gets to a breaking point where they say, screw this. I mean, I love my country, my colonized homeland, but I just have to go somewhere else where I can get better paid. You know, go to New York, which is where a huge percentage of the Puerto Rican population lives, basically in exile in New York. And we see this process of kind of depopulation by using economic mechanisms to force Puerto Ricans out and to turn it into this fiscal paradise for rich capitalists who don't want to pay taxes. and can create like these gated McMansion compounds like we have in Florida. So it's a very difficult struggle. And I understand, I mean, I don't blame them at all why Puerto Ricans want to leave, because it's hard to live in those circumstances. At the same time, we also are seeing a younger generation who are getting more interested in the idea of independence. I'm friends with people from the Puerto Rican Independence Party, and from, you know, the Puerto Rican Independence Party is a good movement. It's a great party, but there are also people who are even to the left of them. The Puerto Rican Independence Party is kind of a social democratic party. They talk about democratic socialism and all that. I mean, but there are also people who are to the left who are even more revolutionary and more militant. And they are growing. I have to say that there's also a generational divide where there are people who were very militant Puerto Rican independence supporters. And those are the people who come from the kind of Young Lords generation. And if people don't know, the Young Lords were like the Puerto Rican version of the Black Panthers. They were these militant Marxists. Some of them were Marxist-Leninists and revolutionary nationalists and very left-wing, very left-wing nationalists. And they were calling for, you know, potential, you know, self-defense and even armed struggle in defense of Puerto Rican independence. And that generation has a lot of them have kind of maintained their politics in support of independence. And there was a generation after, the kind of, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the kind of neoliberal generation, the Reagan era. And for a lot of them, independence was just kind of just removed as a possibility. The US government, the federal government, I mean, carried out brutal repression and in some cases, literal assassinations of Puerto Rican independence leaders, and not even of just Puerto Rican independence leaders who were involved in the armed struggle. There were a lot of Puerto Rican independence leaders who were not involved, who were completely peaceful and who were brutally repressed and imprisoned and in some cases executed. And there's a lot of discussion about what happened to Albizu Campos, who there's a lot of Puerto Ricans who think that he was assassinated by the federal US government. I mean, he was certainly repressed and imprisoned by the US government. So, I mean, we should, just as we know that the US government, the FBI and Chicago Police Department assassinated, they murdered Fred Hampton, yeah, the Chicago Black Panther leader. There was a very similar violent repression of independence leaders in the Puerto Rican movement. And I have to say, though, that there's a younger generation of, you know, people under 40, millennials and Gen Z, who are bringing back the independence concept and issue, and they're struggling for independence. So I think in the short term, unfortunately, the situation looks like it's going to get even worse realistically, with these horrible austerity measures getting worse. And the political situation is very similar as it is in the continental US, where you have two parties that are basically identical. They're both neoliberal. The only difference is that they disagree about state being a state or continuing in this status with like this, like, you know, limbo legal status of being a colony and not being a state. So, I mean, you basically just have these two parties, one of which hilariously calls itself the progressive party, but it's actually a right-wing party. And no one, I mean, all the Puerto Ricans I talk to, no one has confidence that either of these two parties is going to bring any change. But the Puerto Rican Independence Party did surprisingly well in the most recent election, and they're growing. And a lot of their base are young people who are interested in socialism. They're interested in integrating with the rest of Latin America. So I think in the medium to the long term, I think it's not crazy to talk about the Puerto Rican independence movement picking up steam and growing in influence.
Interesting. And I thought it was great that you brought in Fred Hampton when, you know, we're talking about Young Lords and Albizu Campos. You know, there's Fred Hampton was brought down because of his ability to unite, you know, create the Rainbow Coalition there. And so it doesn't seem too far-fetched to think that there are some other people killed by COINTELPRO in that case. So I find your coverage of Cuba and Venezuela to be refreshing. Much of the coverage provided by Western media tries to paint both of these countries as negatively as possible and try to paint a picture of just misery in those countries. So I love this quote from you from last summer about your reporting in Caracas. and working class support for the Maduro government. You said, and what's really wild is whenever I was in a working class barrio, like neighborhood, whenever I was walking around Caracas, poor and working class people are much, much more likely to support the government, much, much more likely to support Maduro. What's missing when most Western media report on Venezuela and Cuba?
The voices of the majority of the population, and specifically the voices of poor and working people. And in the case of Venezuela, what's also very clear, and Cuba, when we're talking about poor and working people in these countries, we're also talking about people who tend to be much darker skinned as opposed to the lighter skinned rich elite. You also can't ignore the racial element in all of this. You know, how many light-skinned rich Cubans in Miami are supposed to be representatives speaking on behalf of the Cuban people, as opposed to the poor and working class dark-skinned Afro-Cubans who support the revolutionary process in Cuba, who are completely ignored by the media. So, I mean, it's very similar in Venezuela. I've been to Venezuela several times, and I'm not saying this to boast in any way, but I'm dead serious. Like, when I was in Venezuela, I didn't just like hang out in like the gated communities in the eastern Chacao area of Caracas, where all the rich people live in their like gated compounds with armed guards and all that. Like, I've been to many working class barrios. I've done interviews with people. I've gone to protests and marches. And like, the reality in Venezuela is that, yes, there have been a lot of economic difficulties, largely caused by the U.S. blockade and sanctions, which are illegal in international law. But the reality is that despite all those difficulties, there still is a very significant mass base in support of Chavismo. And that mass base is almost entirely poor and working people. And why? Because they have something to lose despite the difficulties they've endured in the past several years of the economic crisis and inflation. Although a lot of that's been, by the way, has been finally overcome and managed, and the government has now put the economy back in the path toward growth. And actually, Venezuela has lower inflation now than other countries in Latin America, including Argentina and Ecuador, and even Colombia, apparently, depending on what statistics you use for Colombian inflation. So the reality is that, you know, there were a lot of difficulties caused by this horrible illegal U.S. blockade and sanctions. And a lot of that is because Venezuela has been a petrostate for 100 years. And this is a real problem that Chavistas have tried to deal with, but you can't radically shift the economy of a country that's been a petrostate for 100 years in a few years. It's an extremely difficult, long process. And we actually see, you know, Saudi Arabia is now trying to do that, and they're going to fail, obviously, because the difference is that Saudi Arabia doesn't have a revolutionary grassroots movement. It's all completely top down. But imagine telling Saudi Arabia they have to completely do a 180 and shift their economy because they can no longer export oil. I mean, Saudi Arabia would collapse in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, the government has held on because it does have that working class support from people, because poor and working people, they remember the neoliberal era. They remember the so-called Caracazo, which was this massacre in the neoliberal era in which poor and working people rose up against the neoliberal austerity imposed by the IMF, when there were these structural adjustment programs imposed by the IMF in Venezuela. And specifically, the straw that broke the camel's back was an increase in public transportation prices significantly of the metro system in Venezuela, which, by the way, is very good. It's much better than the New York subway system, and also bus prices. So in response to that, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And there were these large riots and protests in Venezuela. And the government, the neoliberal government, responded of Carlos Andrés Pérez, CAP, responded in his second term with these brutal police and military crackdowns that we don't even know how many people were killed, but apparently 2,000 to 3,000 people, according to the Venezuelan government, were killed in the Caracaso. So poor and working people, they remember the years of neoliberalism. And the difference now is that, yes, there were having economic difficulties, but the government gave them a house, an apartment. The government gave them a job. The government gave them health care. Right. The government gave them dignity. The government gave them these things that they never had before. And that's why so many poor and working people still defend the Bolivarian Revolution launched by Hugo Chavez and continued by Nicolas Maduro. And that's why they still continue to vote for them, by the way, while the right-wing opposition backed by the U.S. boycotts the elections because they can't win them freely and fairly. So all of that is left out. And yes, the inflation is real. I've been to Venezuela several times. I've seen the inflation. I mean, I'm not going to lie. For instance, when I was there in June, July, August, and September of 2019, I arrived, and I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was like 2,300 bolivares to a dollar. And when I left, it was like 6,000 to a dollar. So I mean, we're talking about very bad inflation over just a few months. Like it was very difficult. And a lot of that, again, is because the government has been a petrostate for 100 years, and the U.S. imposed an embargo on it and prevented the government from exporting its oil, which meant that according to the United Nations Special Rapporteur, that is the top expert on sanctions, she visited Venezuela and did a lengthy report. And this UN top expert in sanctions said that the Venezuelan government was starved of 99% of state revenue. How can a country survive if the government is starved of 99% of its revenue? And that's because, again, being realistic, it's a petrostate. Almost all of its government revenue comes from the export of oil. And the U.S. government said that not only can Venezuela not export to the U.S., but what's not understood about these U.S. sanctions and the U.S. blockade, because it's not just sanctions, it's a full-on blockade. Trump declared a full-on economic embargo of Venezuela. What that means is that any country around the world, and not just any country, but any company or in a foreign country around the world, they cannot do business with Venezuela. That means they cannot buy Venezuelan oil, or they risk something called secondary sanctions. And the U.S. was threatening its own so-called allies, including Turkey, South Korea, and India and Japan, who all wanted to buy Venezuelan oil. And the U.S. said, at first, the U.S. gave them a temporary exception and said that for a few months they can continue to buy Venezuelan oil as they look for alternative sources of oil. But then after that, the U.S. said, look, our so-called allies, Korea, South Korea, India, Turkey, etc., you can no longer buy Venezuelan oil, or we're going to impose secondary sanctions on you. So we're talking about a medieval-style blockade. And the fact that the Venezuelan government survived that is a reflection of the fact that the Chavista movement still has this base of popular support. If it were not for that base of popular support, the government would have been overthrown. And that's why, again, we need to think about what would happen if Saudi Arabia was not able to export its oil. It would collapse in a matter of days because it doesn't have the mass base of popular support that the Venezuelan government does have.
Right. So in continuing on this idea of Venezuela and kind of the look to the future here, you recently published an article in which you shared projections saying that there could be potentially a great economic year in 2022 for Venezuela. How do you think this growth would be experienced by the working class?
Yeah, well, this is not my estimate. This is according to Credit Suisse, which is a Swiss bank. And, you know, Swiss banks are known for certainly not being great honest institutions, but they are noted for being independent institutions that are neutral institutions. And Credit Suisse is one of the few banks that has continued allowing business with Venezuela, despite all of the Western sanctions. So they, you know, from their own capitalist perspective, who have investments in Venezuela, they want to understand what's happening in the Venezuelan economy. So, you know, they have a vested interest in providing honest economic analysis, financial analysis of the Venezuelan economy. And they publish, an internal report for their investors. And they predict that the Venezuelan economy, the real GDP growth will be 20% this year in 2022 and 8% in 2023. And that is largely because of a few things. One, because U.S. sanctions have become weakened, because the U.S. has been imposing so many sanctions on so many countries around the world that it's actually encouraging the creation of new mechanisms, economic and financial mechanisms. So, for instance, now we're seeing that multiple Russian banks were kicked out of the SWIFT system. The SWIFT system is used to process international financial transactions and bank payments. And Venezuela was kicked out of the SWIFT system, which meant that Venezuelan banks were not allowed to do transactions, which makes it very difficult to do business with a foreign company. And when I was in Venezuela, at one point, I could use my U.S. credit card. And then after the U.S. imposed certain sanctions, I could no longer use my credit card there. So, I mean, like we were talking about economic strangulation, but you can only do that so much. And more, ironically, that the U.S. has used sanctions, the more and more it's actually facilitated the creation of new economic mechanisms. So now we see that Russia has created this bank processing system called the MIR, the MIR, and also China has its own bank financial transaction processing system. And now China and Russia are actually integrating their bank processing system for bank cards and credit cards and debit cards. And you have Russian banks and Chinese banks who are jointly creating cards that operate on both of those systems. And the Venezuelan economy has also been integrated into these systems. The Chinese economy, the Chinese government has really been an economic lifeline for Venezuela. We were talking about multipolarity, and I said that if it were not for popular support, the Venezuelan government would have been overthrown. Well, there's also another big factor in that, which is China. And let's be real. Honestly, if it were not for China, the Venezuelan government probably also would have collapsed, just because, again, the government was starved of 99% of its revenue. And Venezuela and China have become more important economic partners. And it also helps that China is a massive importer of energy. China, one of its weaknesses is it doesn't have energy. And Russia has a lot of energy. It has a lot of oil and gas and has been exporting that to China. And they're building a third pipeline now between Russia and China. And Venezuela has been sending a lot of its oil to China as well. So, I mean, being realistic, one of the reasons for this economic growth is because Venezuela has been finding alternatives around the U.S. sanctions. There's also the possibility of slight sanctions relief, ironically, because the U.S. has to decide who's worse, Russia or Venezuela. And apparently right now it thinks that Russia's worse. So they're potentially going to have some slight sanctions relief. Although, again, we should not be overstating that, because the sanctions are still absolutely brutal on Venezuela. And by the way, they're completely illegal according to international law. And they've resulted in tens of thousands of civilian deaths. And so that's another factor. And then finally, the other factor is the Venezuelan government has finally managed to help control the inflation. And that's a whole very long discussion of how they did that. There was a lot of mechanisms how they did that. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to take two steps back to take one step forward. So they've had to take some, you know, steps against some of currency control. And specifically, they've also had to implement partial dollarization of the economy, which is, being realistic, a lot of Venezuelans have been paying for things in dollars because of the devaluation of the currency. And we don't have time to get into that whole long conversation, because there's also, like, in addition to the sanctions, there was this very strange, very suspicious kind of currency war that was waged in Venezuela from all these Florida-based and U.S.-based groups, like this company called Dollar Today, which would try to artificially create this black market rate for the exchange rate between the Bolivar and the dollar, which would artificially hike up the rate and push it up further and further every single day. And there's a lot of accusations. A lot of people in Venezuela think that's the CIA behind that. I mean, who knows who's behind it, but it's based in the U.S. and it's run by these very wealthy right-wing Venezuelan expats living in the U.S. And basically it was a campaign of psychological and economic warfare to push up the Venezuelan currency. And what happened is a lot of these private capitalists in Venezuela, because a huge part of the Venezuelan economy is still privately owned. I mean, the government, they nationalized the commanding heights of the economy, like the natural resources, the oil, the telecommunications grid, the transportation, but there's still a lot of private companies. And a lot of those private companies, they would, if you go to a store in Venezuela, they would have like a whiteboard with like a marker, or like a blackboard with like chalk. And then every single day, or even multiple times a day, they would change the exchange rate for the dollar and the bolivar. And they wouldn't use the government exchange rate. They would use the black market exchange rate, which is established by these US-based companies like Dólar TV. So that what that would do is that would artificially raise the inflation. And then the government would be forced to try to, because there's so many private companies that refuse to use the government rate, they won't take money from you at the government rate because it's lower. They will only take money from you at the rate established by these private US-based companies. So that forces the government to try to like sometimes to try to tag behind their official, the black market rate. So anyway, it's this complicated whole very long conversation where it would artificially push up inflation, and that played another big factor. But the government has managed to finally to manage inflation. And as of February of this year, inflation was in double digits. It was around 7%, which, I mean, for Venezuela is actually pretty good. I mean, it was really bad. And especially considering how bad inflation has become, even in much of the world outside of Venezuela, with the rise in commodities prices and all of that, like the fact that Venezuela's inflation has become in the single digits is pretty impressive. So all those factors come into play to explain why the Venezuelan economy is finally going to be back on a path toward growth after shrinking pretty substantially under this brutal economic warfare in the past few years.
Right. And there's just so much more that I'd love to talk with you about. And we will have to try to find another time to do that. I will be tuning in and checking out Multipolarista much more often. Really fascinating conversation, Benjamin Norton. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Do you have anything that you want to plug for our listeners? Anything exciting coming up? Anything you want them to tune in or check out?
No, I mean, people can go to multipolarista.com and check out what I'm doing there. And I tweet at Benjamin Norton. And yeah, you can find pretty much everything I do there. I'm also on Telegram, which is becoming more popular, which is good because of all the censorship social media. So you can find me on all of those platforms. And thanks for having me. This is a very cool podcast. Thanks for giving me a platform to talk about these things. And keep up the good coverage.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'll have links to all those things in the show notes for listeners who want to check it out directly there. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thanks.